This is Jim Inkster coming today. We'll visit with Ben Bradley Jr. His book is The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams, a man who lived a remarkable life from 1918 to 2002 and was cryogenically frozen after his departure. We'll talk with Ben Bradley about perhaps the greatest hitter of his generation or any other. Also on the show, Gene Sands, formerly public relations director at LSU, on the new interest in Walt Disney and some reflections on his days at the old war school. And Phil Robertson is back as the commander of Duck Dynasty. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It's 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest is Ben Bradley Jr. He spent a quarter century at the Boston Globe as a reporter and editor. As deputy managing editor, he oversaw many critically acclaimed stories, including the Globe's Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage of the sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. He lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, not far from where Ted Williams ruled the world as the greatest hitter of his generation. And his book, Ben Bradley Jr.'s book, is The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams, a voluminous book about Ted Williams and all his glory and all his foibles. Good morning, Ben Bradley Jr.
Morning, Jim. How are you?
Doing well. Now, you were exposed to Ted Williams as a kid. You grew up in Boston in the 1950s, and I guess it was kind of hard to ignore Mr. Ted Williams.
Yes, it was. My room as a kid was plastered with pictures of Williams clipped out from Sports Illustrated and Sport Magazine, and I would go over to Fenway Park as often as I could to watch him play, and he was something to see. He had a real presence about him, and when he came to bat, the atmosphere in the park changed, and people would come to the edge of their seats, and there was electricity in the air. I remember being struck by a story that one of the old sports writers of the day told me about. One day he saw a blind man at the Fenway Park, and he approached the man and said, "Excuse me, why do you come to the games when you could be home listening to them on the radio?" And the guy said, I like the sounds of the park when Ted Williams comes to bat."
Huh. And that he did like no one else in his time, and there were some great players in his time, but he was great right up to the end, homered in his last at-bat in 1960 and played in four decades.
But, right.
But that career was interrupted by military service, lots of military service, and if not for that, Ted Williams would very well have hit 700 home runs and be regarded as perhaps the greatest player in the history of the game. His military service can't be ignored. It was a significant part of his life.
Definitely, and I think one of the most interesting parts of his life, especially when compared to really the unfathomable probability that a modern superstar would interrupt his career to serve in not one war, but two. It just doesn't compute. I don't think you can picture Alex Rodriguez in Afghanistan or Iraq, can you?
No.
So that's really interesting. And as you suggested, one of the main topics of discussion that comes up when people talk about Ted Williams is trying to project what his final statistics would have been had he not missed nearly 5 years of his prime to World War II and Korea. And he probably would have been up around 700 home runs, just shy of Ruth's record of 714. Of course, this is the pre-steroids era. And but I concluded in the book, in the final analysis, that Williams's legacy was enhanced by his service in those two wars, and not just doing KP duty. He was an elite Marine Corps fighter pilot, and he was shot down in Korea, and this gave him a heroic ethos, which I think was more important to his legacy than merely compiling more home runs and base hits.
Well, the numbers he amassed on the diamond are significant. A lifetime batting average .344. And for those who've gotten into the peripheral statistics, how about this one? Lifetime on base percentage .482.
Lifetime all time record.
Lifetime slugging percentage .634. He was an amazing hitter, but he did not play on the New York Yankees as Joe DiMaggio did, who was of the same vintage. And Jolton Joe was not nearly the player that Ted Williams was, but history has regarded him perhaps as a bigger star because he was on so many world champions. I'm sure that ate at Ted Williams.
Well, we certainly shouldn't diminish DiMaggio and what a great player he was. He was, I think, certainly a better all-around player than Williams. Williams was, by his own admission, a one-dimensional player. Really all he cared about was hitting. He was indifferent at best to fielding and the other fine points of the game. He was famously quoted as saying at one point, they don't pay off on fielding. And that's really true. If you look at press coverage of modern-day players, the first thing that's cited is always their offensive statistics, what the fellow hit, and so forth, not his defensive percentage. But DiMaggio was a great all-around player, and maybe the greatest in the eyes of some. He did have a better supporting cast with the Yankees than Williams did with the Red Sox. In the 50s, the Red Sox were consistently terrible. And the only reason to come to Fenway Park was Ted Williams.
Well, and Williams only played in one World Series, and unfortunately for him, he didn't play that well in the one series he played in. And
right.
I'm sure that was a disappointment that followed him to the grave.
Yeah, that really stuck in his craw. And he was disappointed that he hit only .205 in the seven game series in 1946 against the St. Louis Cardinals, and the Cardinals won in the seventh game. And it was a long train ride back to Boston from St. Louis.
Well, it's interesting. You, as the biographer of Williams, are kind of taking the side of Joe DiMaggio, is saying he was a better overall player. I would argue that Williams was so far ahead of DiMaggio as an offensive force that superseded the defensive advantage that DiMaggio had. Williams, the numbers are just remarkable to this day. 2,021 bases on balls, 709 strikeouts. The guy hit like few other people have before or since. Do you think he thought he got his due? After all, the year he hit .401, he was not the most valuable player. Or .406 in 1941, he was not the most valuable player in the league that year. Joe DiMaggio was.
Yeah. Well, he took the high road on that, and he was always more generous privately and publicly, really, to DiMaggio than Joe was to him. Joe Joe acknowledged Ted is a great hitter, but privately to his friends and associates, he would disparage Williams. He would say, "Tell him to hold up his hand. How many rings has he got?" That kind of thing, and say he's the greatest left-handed hitter in the history, that kind of thing.
Well, and
Go ahead.
No, I say, as we know, DiMaggio was a complex individual off the diamond as well, but Williams, I mean, the complexity of him has followed him to the grave. As one reviewer writes of your book in the New York Times, so the hero gets his head cut off on page 11. What happened to Ted Williams at the end?
Well, the cryonics affair was a sad coda to the life of the greatest hitter who ever lived. What happened was that his son, John Henry, got interested in cryonics, which is not a science, really, but a fringe movement adhered to by a few thousand people, I guess, around the country, who believe that science will advance to the point where it will one day be possible to cure you of whatever disease it is that kills you, and that you'll be, quote, reanimated, as they call it, and come back to life. There are a lot of holes in the theory. They haven't worked out, for example, whether Ted Williams would come back as an 83-year-old man or a young stud who could hit 406 again. They just don't know. It's based on hope, and people compare it to playing the lottery. And, if there's even the most remote chance, why not do it? So goes the argument. And Claudia Williams, John Henry himself died at age 35, I think, in 2004, shortly, less than 2 years after his father died. And he himself decided to be frozen, and his remains are with his father's at this facility in Arizona called Alcor. And so according to Claudia Williams, the youngest, John Henry's sister and Ted's youngest daughter, there was a family meeting in 2000, about a year and a half before Ted died. And by this time, John Henry and Claudia had decided that cryonics was something that they wanted to do, and they wanted their father to join them in this so that they could be together, quote, forever. And Ted was about to have an operation to have a pacemaker installed down in Florida. And since no surgery for a man that age is normal, they thought they would approach their father and ask him before he went under the knife if he would agree to this. And she says that he did. But my research suggests that if he did, he was not of sound mind at the time. And I was able to track down about a dozen people whom he told after that date that, no, he wanted to be cremated and have his ashes thrown off the Florida Keys, where he had lived and fished for many years, and as his will specified. So I think whether Ted himself wanted cryonics is very much in question.
The book is The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams, from Ben Bradley Jr., who, like many young men in the 1950s, followed the life and times of Theodore Samuel Williams, born August 30th, 1918, a birthday he shares with another mercurial figure that Louisianians know well, Huey Long. San Diego, California is where it began for Ted Williams. He died at 83 in Florida, and he had quite a life as a player, and then a remarkable life after baseball. And we'll talk with Ben Bradley Jr. about Ted Williams and how it all began, as well as a Mexican-American, part of his life that is not often detailed, and something that Ted Williams didn't talk a whole lot about. We'll return with Ben Bradley Jr. after this 90-second pause. 297-5633, your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. J.C. Kane producing. And our guest for a bit longer is Ben Bradley Jr. The book, The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams, is stated. His life began in 1918, August 30th, San Diego, California. He was not extremely proud of the origins of life. Why was he not proud of his childhood, Ben Bradley Jr.?
Well, one really interesting fact about Williams that he chose to conceal for almost all of his life was the fact that he was Mexican-American. His mother was Mexican, born there. Her parents were born there, and the family on her side went back as far as I was able to trace. And Ted decided that it would not be helpful to his career to acknowledge that he was Mexican-American. He was afraid of that the prejudice of the day could hurt his career, even though there was more prejudice in evidence against black players than Mexicans. He wasn't taking any chances. And one of the first interviews that I did, starting research on this book nearly a decade ago now, was with some of Williams's cousins, most of on the Mexican side, who are centered in the Santa Barbara area of California. And they told me a very revealing story that happened in 1939, the end of Williams's rookie season, in which he had set the American League on fire, won the runs batted in championship, hit well over 300. And he returned to San Diego, the conquering hero. And when he arrived at the train station, there were over 100 of his relatives on the Mexican side gathered to give him a great welcome. Ted got off the train and took one look at all these people and hightailed it in the opposite direction. Didn't want to be seen with them. And that stuck in the craw of a lot of these folks and their descendants. Still to this day.
What about the volcanic temper that followed him throughout his career and beyond?
He struggled with anger, and I think it was rooted in resentment of his mother. His mother was a soldier in the South Asian Army, known as Salvation May. She had a mission that stretched from Tijuana to north to Los Angeles, but was centered on the streets of San Diego in the Depression. She was a very well-known figure politically. And for this woman, the Salvation Army was everything. She would be out until all hours of the night saving souls and not home for Ted and his younger brother, Danny. And they were some of the first latchkey kids. They were out on the front stoop of their house waiting for their mother to come home. And the father was a drunk and a ne'er-do-well, largely absent, ended up leaving the family, running off with another woman. And Ted was very, very resentful of that and ashamed of the family's modest circumstances that didn't have some of the finer things in life. I mean, he grew up on the wrong side of the tracks, and in a very almost Dickensian childhood. And baseball became his salvation. It was luckily for him, there was a playground a few blocks away from his house that had floodlights, so he could stay up, he could play ball into the night in the favorable climate of San Diego. And that's what he did. But he stayed angry about that, and it became a double-edged sword for him, this anger. He was able to, he always said that he hit better mad, and he nurtured his rage, as one writer put it. And So he would manufacture feuds against the baseball writers whom he thought were always unfair to him, and get himself psyched up and go off on a tear and hit 500 for a month or so. But in his private life, this anger caused him enormous difficulty. It would bubble up at inappropriate times and really cost him his three marriages and caused him great difficulty relating to his three children.
Well, on the field, he showed anger on occasion, and in 1958, when he was 40 years old, he threw a bat in the stands and almost killed a lady.
Well, I witnessed that as a kid. I happened to be at Fenway Park that day. He had struck out, which was always a rare thing. He hardly ever struck out. And he had a temper, as mentioned, and he went to throw his bat in disgust, and he intended to throw it on the ground, and but he had the rosin and stickum in his hands. He lost control of the bat, and it went sailing into the box seats and hit this elderly lady in the face, and her face was all bloodied, and it was a bad scene. And Williams was mortified, and he rushed over and tended to the lady and asked if she was okay. And a sports writer of the day told me a funny story about his experience that day. He thought the Red Sox might get sued as a result of this. The lady looked really hurt, and she might bring a lawsuit. So the fellow ran into the clubhouse and talked to Joe Cronin, who was then the general manager of the team, and said, "Joe, aren't the Red Sox concerned about a lawsuit here?" Joe said, "Oh, no, there'll be no lawsuit." "Why is that?" says the reporter. "Because this woman happens to be my housekeeper, and she loves Ted Williams." Ted got out of that pickle.
A question from a listener about Williams' military service. Joe notes that in 1942, Williams won the Triple Crown, year after he batted 406, by the way. And then he went in the military, served in World War II, 43, 44, 45. Was his service voluntary?
It was, but with an asterisk. Obviously after Pearl Harbor, the patriotic fervor was running high, and many people were rushing to enlist. But Williams initially had a deferment. It was called a 3A, which was the code meant he was deferred because he was the sole supporter of his mother. By that time, the father had left the family, and the younger brother was not a factor. He was always one step ahead of the sheriff and in jail and had his own issues. So Ted was, in fact, the sole supporter of his mother. And he also, though, he wanted to play ball. He was coming off his 406 season. He'd gotten a big raise. He wanted to earn his money, and his position was that the 3A deferment was legitimate, which it was, but there was still the question of what was his larger responsibility at a time when we had been attacked by the Japanese. And as the season wore on, the pressure for him to enlist grew enormous. He was getting some hate mail. He would get blank pieces of paper in the mail, colored yellow, the color of cowardice. And finally, he decided to enlist. He reached a deal, an understanding with the Navy in midsummer of 1942, that he would enlist at the end of the season if they let him finish out the 1942. Season, in which, as you said, he won the Triple Crown.
Well, it's an amazing life, Ted Williams the Kid, the immortal life of Ted Williams from Ben Bradley Jr. And this man was a hitter with no peer in 1957, when he was 39 years old, he batted 388. We'll try to slide in a few calls and let Ben go. Dan downtown. Dan, good morning. You're on with Ben Bradley, Jr.
Yes, so Mr. Bradley, I know that the bat incident may have been an accident, but I distinctly remember a photo back in the late 50s of him spitting at the fans when he was out in the outfield.
Yeah. Yeah, he not only that, and he gave him the finger, too, on another occasion. He had a very, very thin-skinned, and even though he was generally extremely popular in Boston, there was a small faction of the fans who could see that they could get under his skin. And, you know, he couldn't react the way players of today are commonly trained to react, which is to ignore boos, ignore abuse. He had what they call rabbit ears. You know, he was able to pick out even one boo amidst all the cheers. And he couldn't take criticism well. I mean, he reasoned that he was an expert at what he did. He was trying his best, and that criticism was unfair. And when fans would give him the business, he would turn. And so some days, this one day that you referenced, he spat into all quarters of the field. You know, he gave it to the left field, he gave it to the center field, he gave it to the right field, and he was fined, then unheard of sum of $5,000 by Tom Yawkey, but the fine was never collected.
He never tipped his cap, did he?
He never tipped his cap, which was, you know, that started way back in 1940, his second year in the league, when, again, he couldn't take criticism. The fans got on him early that year when he wasn't delivering as they thought he should have. They'd moved in the fences for him. Fenway Park had a 400-foot right field fence. And after the 1939 season, the owner, Tom Yawkey, moved the fences in 20 feet by constructing bullpens in front of the fence. And so everyone thought this was the new area where Williams' home runs would go. And the local press called it Williamsburg as the place where these home runs would land. Huh. But it didn't. He got off to a slow start. They started to boo him. And he said, that's it. I'm never going to tip my hat again to these fans. And he held to that promise even on his last at-bat in 1960 when he homered. And what a way to end his career. And he later said that he thought about it as he was rounding second, because if ever there was a time when he would tip his hat, that would be it. But he held true to that promise and ended up in retirement. He became really a beloved figure later. He was always puzzled by why he seemed more popular in retirement than he did as a player. But when he returned to be honored at Fenway Park in 1991 on the 50th anniversary of his 406 season, that was the time in which he made a grand show of tipping his hat to the fans of New England.
Well, you note, Ben, that in 1960, when Ted finished his career and homered in his last at-bat on September 29th, 1960, he was 42. He was actually a year younger than then-Senator Kennedy, who was running for president, who was considered too young to be president, and Williams is finishing a fabulous career at 42. But even though their lives intersected, they were of the same age, you note that Williams nursed a personal grudge against Joe Kennedy for giving him a bum stock tip.
Yeah, that seems sort of a petty reason to be against the son, but that was his feeling. But I think it was more rooted in his conservative politics. He was a Nixon man, Ted. He loved Nixon. And JFK idolized Williams, and there was a funny story in the presidential campaign of 1960. Nixon and Kennedy both came to Miami to address the AFL-CIO convention, and JFK comes up in his plane, and he bumps into Cecil Williams getting off the tarmac wearing a Nixon button. And, you know, and he got quite upset and disillusioned that his hero was wearing a Nixon button.
He was a fabulous-looking guy in his prime, and you have some photos with Mickey Mantle, who also was a handsome man, but there's no doubt in the photo you have in 1955 who is dominating, and that's the 6'3", tanned, magnificent Ted Williams, certainly a more handsome man than Joe DiMaggio, yet he got very few endorsements. A listener notes that he endorsed Lucky Strike cigarettes. Is that right?
He did, and he always regretted that because he never smoked, and so it was hypocritical, and he worried that it set a bad example for kids, and he always said that he was going to return the money, but he never did, and felt badly about that.
Finally, did he die a happy man?
Well, That's hard to say. I think that my reporting suggests that he died with quite a lot of anxiety and perhaps second thoughts over the decision to be cryonically preserved. You know, he asked several friends to see a lawyer and expressed misgivings about this. So I think he died with great foreboding and anxiety about that.
A most complex man. He got 83 years, and he was a fellow who did not live a life of moderation. He milked it for about all it could be milked for, and we've had Denny McClain on this show a few times. Of course, was a rogue of the first realm, and he notes that Williams was more than his match, that he was a very difficult man to work for when McClain was pitching for the Washington Senators in 1970.
Yeah, they didn't like each other. Ted was always quite disparaging of pitchers as a player. He would call them dumb and to their face, and that didn't help him as a manager when, you know, he's manager of the pitchers as well as the hitters. And managing was when his one-dimensional approach to the game perhaps hurt him. Well, he did get Manager of the Year his first year back to in baseball with the Washington Senators. But after that, I think he gradually lost interest. And he was against the Senators acquiring McClain. They had to give up a lot of guys for him, like the.
We got to roll, but thank you very much, Ben Bradley. Thank you for a great conversation and a fantastic book, The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF. In Baton Rouge, 2 days to go in 2013, and we're glad you're rounding out the year with 89.3. 297-5633 is your number outside the area. It is 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. We are slated to hear from Gene Sands in just a bit, and hopefully the former LSU public relations director will share some time with us. And of course, he spent many years in Anaheim working for the Walt Disney Company as a young man, and Walt Disney's back in the news with this film, Saving Mr. Banks, with Tom Hanks playing Mr. Disney. And we'll talk, hopefully, with Mr. Gene Sands, always an interesting man who spent some fascinating years on the campus at LSU. And if anything, the politics have become more intense in the years since Sands left. Did want to note that Bill Robertson of Duck Dynasty has been reinstated by A&E. That was a short-lived suspension. We visited with John Dennison of the Forum for Equality and Gene Mills of the Louisiana Family Forum. And Gene Mills predicted that A&E would apologize for suspending Mr. Robertson. And I don't know that they have overtly apologized, but obviously the suspension amounted to absolutely nothing since nine shows were in the can and they're already ready to go. And I'm sure Mr. Robertson will be back in the fold for when they start filming again. So the suspension amounted to nothing. After all, this show generates about 12, 14 million viewers on some nights. And money talks and the remarks that were made by Phil Robertson that were at the best insensitive to the gay community did not result in him losing his job. 297-5633, if you'd like to comment on this, 877-217-5757. Interestingly, one of the first people out in front on this was Bobby Jindal, the governor of Louisiana. Governor Jindal defended Phil Robertson, said that he was being deprived of his free speech rights, and I think that that might be a bit of a stretch. There was certainly no First Amendment violation by A&E for suspending Phil Robertson as a private company. Bobby Jindal is one who often talks about how he likes the private sector. Well, in the private sector, if somebody says something you don't like, and you're the boss, you can take action. And A&E did take some action, but obviously backed away from the action that was taken. But nonetheless, to say this was a First Amendment issue is smacking of hyperbole at the very best. And Governor Jindal was not alone. He was followed quickly by Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden, who said that he would personally go out and find another distributor for Robertson's program, Duck Dynasty, if the suspension was not lifted, and it was. So presumably Robertson and Duck Dynasty will stay on A&E. And this man has become a political force in Louisiana, and Bobby Jindal found out quicker than anybody else. Governor Jindal, of course, had his entire political machine backing Neil Reiser for U.S. Congress in the 5th District. And Reiser ran first in the primary, but then was defeated handily in the runoff by Vance McAllister in a race in which McAllister got 60% of the votes. And McAllister's greatest claim to fame, he's a successful businessman, but he was best known as the candidate supported by Phil Robertson in the 5th District. So I think these politicians took note and decided that courting Mr. Robertson would be a very good thing for their political endeavors. And Governor Jindal is one who has political endeavors at the highest level and probably yearns for the prospect of Phil Robertson backing him for president of the United States. Bobby Jindal said he was backing a Louisiana person, and that he was, but he was also backing a Louisiana person that he found out firsthand has great political stature. And the popularity of Phil Robertson may very well have resulted in Vance McAllister ending up being a member of Congress, despite having never been to Washington prior to the election. 297-5633, if you'd like to comment in our time about Governor Bobby Jindal and his support for Phil Robertson. And I must say, Governor Jindal was not alone. I don't know of any politician who denounced Phil Robertson. Some didn't say anything, including Mary Landrieu, but others were quick to comment and defend Robertson vigorously, saying that they thought that this man deserved his First Amendment rights. And Governor Jindal even went so far as to compare Phil Robertson to Miley Cyrus, saying that it was somewhat curious that she was still on the air. And for a few days, Robertson was suspended, but he was never taken off the air because these shows are filmed well in advance. And the reality show that Robertson is involved with has certainly fared better than The Governor's Wife, which was also an A&E production and ended up not being one that lasted very long, didn't make it a month. 297-5633. Marcia in Clinton. Good morning, Marcia. You're on the air. Thanks for calling WRKF. Hi, Marcia.
I'd like to make a comment. I don't think that Vance McAllister won so much because of Phil Robinson backing him as so much that the other guy was backed by Dindal. I mean, I held my nose to vote for McAllister. I would have preferred a Democrat.
You're in that district?
Yes, I am, unfortunately. And as far as Phil Robinson and that group...
By the way, it's Robertson. It's not
Robertson. I'm sorry, Robertson. I don't even watch the show. I've never even looked at it. I feel a show about a bunch of people who make money shooting ducks and helping other people shoot ducks and portraying Louisiana people as a bunch of backwoods hillbillies does not do anything for our state. It perpetuates this idea that we're a bunch of people who'll shoot anything that moves who live in swamps. Well, and that is far from my experience of this state.
Sarah Palin was quick to back Mr. Robertson. And
yes.
I must say that Bobby Jindal was followed in close proximity on this by Lieutenant Governor Jay Darden.
Oh, I know. And let me tell you, neither one of those men is ever going to get my vote for anything. It's time for the Democrats to pick themselves up and go forward. And we need to stop letting these ultra-conservative, just hateful people, like what Phil said was just horrible. And also, they are very, very misogynist. They think women need to be in the kitchen cooking and barefoot and pregnant. And that's like so yesterday. That's all I can say about it. As a Louisianian, I just cringe every time anyone asks me about these shows like Swamp People and Duck Dynasty.
All right. You like The Governor's Wife? Was that...
No, or not. I don't like reality shows. I don't really watch a lot of television, to tell you the truth. I have my own life to live. I'm not going to sit there and live through somebody else vicariously. But anyway, Jim, you have a happy new year.
Thank you, Marcia. Appreciate your listening and calling. 297-5633 is your number. Robin on O'Neill. Good morning, Robin. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Fine.
I'm calling because every time this comes up, they always only mention the gay issue. The man said that black people were happier before they had their civil rights. To me, that's the most disgusting thing he said, and it's never mentioned. Once in a blue moon, someone will mention it.
Well, he didn't put it quite like that, but he certainly implied that. There's no doubt he said that they were singing and enjoying life. And
happy folk.
Yeah, and that things were pretty good for black people in the 1950s. What was Mr. Robertson ingesting to believe something like that? Do you think he really believes that?
Yes, I do believe he believes that. I do believe he's one of those people who pick something out of the Bible to suit his own prejudices.
Okay.
When there's many things in the Bible that they're not following, but they pick that out because that's what makes them comfortable.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Robin. And
right,
appreciate
you.
your comments. 297-5633 is your number. Evan in Mid-City. Hi, Evan. You're on the air. Good morning.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to just ask a question for those who say about free speech. What's the difference between Phil Robinson and the Westboro Baptist Church, who protests at military funerals and funerals of very prominent people? Fox News in particular often condemns Westboro Church and does never says that, well, it's their First Amendment right to be out there protesting, but they came very eagerly to defense of Bill Robinson. You know, I say free speech is free speech. So if you support Bill Robinson, you must.
Okay, his name is Robertson, not Robert.
Robertson, sorry. But, if you support one, you know, you must support the other. You can't be selective in who you say can have free speech and who cannot have it. So that's just my comment.
Well, that's true. And I must say that on this show, on occasion, I've had people, and it comes down quite often to whether or not somebody agrees with what the person is saying. There's free speech as long as somebody's in agreement in many cases, and then if somebody doesn't like what somebody's saying, then suddenly they don't have a right to say what they believe. If it's reprehensible, it perhaps needs to be exposed more so than not. How else are we going to know what's going on if we don't give people a voice? 297-5633, Charles on North Foster. Good morning, Charles. You're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. Good morning to your audience. Let me say this. There's a bigger issue than free speech here. There's a pattern by ABC and ESPN, who are the parent companies of A&E. Like I said earlier in your show last week, you have Dog the Bounty Hunter, talks about black people like dogs, calls us all kind of epitaphs, and says what we don't do with black people. They suspended him, put him back on. Well, those good old folks at the Duck Dynasty, they did the same thing. All this time, while young black men are putting their life and lives on the line in these college bowl games on ESPN, folks, we got a lot more clout than we recognize. ABC, ESPN, A&E, let them pay where it counts,
well,
in the pocket.
All right, and that company, all those companies are affiliated with the Walt Disney Company.
Walt Disney
Company.
That's right. Mr. Disney, who also has a colorful past, if you know what I mean.
Well, Walt Disney died in 1966, but...
yeah.
But anyway.
His spirit lives on.
All right, Charles, thank you. Good to hear from you. And now we're joined by Gene Sands. Speaking of Walt Disney, Gene Sands grew up in Anaheim, California. Worked at Disneyland, right?
Yeah, worked at Disneyland when I was in junior high school and high school.
You were there when it opened, 1955, right?
Yeah. Yeah, not the same park it is today, by the way. It's much different.
Well, Disneyland and Walt Disney, they're back in the news with Tom Hanks playing Mr. Disney. Would Disney be pleased with Hanks' portrayal of him in Saving Mr. Banks?
Yes.
Why?
Well, I think, I'm sorry, repeat your question.
About Walt Disney, would he be pleased with Hanks' portrayal of him?
I think he would. I think Hanks did a very good job. I mean, it's difficult to portray Walt Disney in one sense because, you know, he was not an actor, he was not slick, he was a guy from a Midwestern farm who really never lost a lot of those qualities, so... I think Hanks did an admirable job. I was talking to some folks over the weekend, and they said to me that Richard Sherman, the half of the Sherman Brothers writing team that wrote all the music for Mary Poppins, was highly instrumental in coaching Hanks on Walt's various mannerisms.
The movie's made, I think, about $44 million thus far. It's paid its bills, but it's not an overwhelming hit. But Hanks and Emma Thompson have gotten high marks for their work in Saving Mr. Banks. Walt Disney died in 1966. He was 65 years old.
Yeah.
He died from lung cancer.
He was
a heavy smoker, wasn't he?
He was a very heavy smoker.
Does Hanks smoke in the film?
No, he is not shown ever smoking in the film.
But that was a big part of Walt Disney.
Oh, very much so. They used to say you could tell when Walt was coming down the hall because you could hear him cough before he got there. He was a very heavy smoker. And he smoked these unfiltered cigarettes he had brought in from Mexico, and that didn't do him any good either.
Well, when you were at Disneyland, you rubbed shoulders with people like, well, there was a woman named Diane Hall at the time, right?
Yes, that's right. She later became Annie Hall.
Diane
Hall
Keaton.
Was actually her grandmother.
Diane Keaton, right?
Name. Yeah.
How did you end up being associated with her?
Well, I was in high school at the same time she was in high school, and we used to do essentially crosstown drama contest, and we exchanged plays once in a while. Of course, none of us had an idea then that she would be so famous, and none of us thought Steve Martin would be that famous, so you just never know.
Steve Martin also in those early years, and of course you ended up meeting a gentleman named Wally Bogue and writing a book about the Clown Prince of Disneyland. But after all those years at Disney, you ended up at LSU.
Yeah.
Disney, was it like Disneyland, or was it somewhat different?
Well, there were some days when it was, and there were some days when it wasn't, of course. I used to say that before I came here, of course, I was in the Pentagon, and we used to call that Disneyland East. And I've got a great cartoon a friend of mine drew of one of the security guards at the entrance. He's got a family out there with a Mickey Mouse balloon, and he said, "I'm telling you, folks, this is not Disneyland East. It's the Pentagon." Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of similarities there, I think.
Well, you've been away from LSU for how long now, Gene?
8 years.
8 years. Yeah. So you were there during the Sean O'Keefe years.
Oh, unfortunately.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
He was tough?
Well, he's a primary reason I left LSU.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I couldn't work for him. And I'd always told my PR students, if you have a boss that you just don't seem to have the right chemistry with and you don't feel you can support, you owe it to yourself and the organization to leave. And that was a wise move, I believe. I still believe that. He really needed his own PR guy there. And he, as I understand, he wanted to bring in his own PR guy and was not able to. So I was not on the top of his Christmas card list.
It doesn't sound like it. What's your, we're short, but what's your take on, early take on the new guy, King
well,
Alexander?
You know, he seems to, he's come aboard very well, like most good chancellors and presidents. He has a lot of daunting issues facing him with this new organization of the president slash chancellor. Of course, he now runs the whole system and the LSU campus.
Big job.
Yes, it is.
Well, we'll talk with you, I hope, sometime during the year about what's happening at the old war school. Gene Sands, who has gotten to know it pretty well. Thank you for joining us today. Happy New Year to you.
And to you.
And we'll be back tomorrow on New Year's Eve for J.C. Kane. I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.